Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on The Big Lead. I'm Ryan Glaspiegel. We're joined by Peter King this week. I spent about 14 hours with Peter King starting at 6:30 a.m. ending close to 9 o'clock last week during Super Bowl week in Minneapolis, and I chronicled his day for a story for The Big Lead that accompanies this podcast. So, as you mentioned earlier, you've done 34 Super Bowls. You've been in this profession a long time. You're, I think, pretty objectively the dean of football sports writing. What motivates you to get up and do a 6:30 a.m. radio spot when you're just so established already, like your legacy's undisputed? Why are you still doing that at 60 years old?
I like Ross Tucker, and he's, you know, he's a really good friend. And I've known him for a long time, and he wrote a story for us when he retired from football about retiring from football, and it was kind of an emotional thing for him to do. And I've talked to him a lot over the years about you know, how good he is and how conversational he is and how he can be really good in this job, in the whole media business. And I just really like him. He's fun. He's a good guy. And he's got a job to do. I've got a job to do. If I can help him, I want to help him. And, you know, I just like, I like doing it. I like the whole scene. It's fun. It's, it gets me going. It's a good time. So I don't ever feel like, I really don't feel, I would have probably rather slept another hour today, but I was happy to go and do it, just, and also because it's fun. I mean, there I am talking to two, honestly, talking to two offensive linemen who are really smart. I can learn something from them too. So I just don't view it as anything too deep or dark. It's just, I kind of like it. I like the conversation.
There was a Deadspin story earlier this season where you said, where they said they had heard you were considering possibly scaling back after the season. I reached out to you and I heard something similar. So I'm interested. Have you, you said you're taking it one day at a time, but have you come to any decision about what your career looks like beyond the Super Bowl?
Not really, other than I really don't want to do quite as much as I'm doing right now. And look, I have a great job, mostly with Sports Illustrated now. I have a small little piece with NBC, a little story on the pregame show on Sunday. but mostly, it's a Sports Illustrated, the MMQB deal. And I think, so we've done the MMQB for 5 years. Yeah. This year, we combined the MMQB with SI, some reasons financial, some reasons journalistic. I mean, we were duplicating, you know, last year around the time of the Super Bowl, we had two separate stories the same week about Tom Brady. So I think the powers that be, and I totally understood, thought, you know, let's put this together and combine forces. And so it's been, that's really worked out well. I've been happy with it. But there's just something about sort of being in charge. You know, for the first, think about it, for the first maybe 33 years of my sports writing career, I was on my own. I was alone. And then for the last 5 years, I've done mostly what I have done for a long time, and I was a boss. I hired people, I ran this site, I didn't really run the site. Mark Moravec of our staff really ran it, you know, because I was always out or always, you know, writing and
yeah,
all
but
that.
You're contributing story ideas. You're introducing your young writers to your Rolodex of like 50,000 contacts, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing more than just writing, obviously. But, and so, I think I've gotten to the point where the boss part of it is probably not something I'm going to continue doing. Because you have to make choices in life. And for a long time, for now 34 years covering the NFL, you know, I've thrown myself into my job and I've worked pretty constantly and pretty hard. And I sometimes wake up and say, is that all there is? And I feel bad for my wife, quite honestly, because she has sacrificed for me for all of our marriage for, it'll be 38 years this year. And so, whatever decision I make, and I truly, truly do not know what I'm going to do. And I don't really want to start thinking about it until after the Super Bowl. My contract is up at the end of March. And I'll just, you know, consider my options, and I'll probably do the best thing for me that would be maybe a little bit more manageable pace than what I've done. Maybe I'll write the column, maybe I'll do some special things, maybe I'll continue to do a few things for NBC. That would be totally up to them. And then we'll just see what happens. So I don't want to string this out. I don't want to be any source of any great mystery, but it's just that I just really don't think it, first of all, I would never get anything resolved now, and I just don't think it helps me trying to do my job now. The same issues are going to be there in 2 weeks,
right?
So I'll just start to figure it out in February, and then I don't know when I'll make my decision, but I'll start to figure it out in February and we'll see.
So this is going to be a little bit of a sensitive question. I understand if you want to duck it. Clearly, you are left-leaning. That's pretty obvious by your Twitter account. The Sports Illustrated, where you've been for years and years and years, and everybody who knows you knows of you from being from SI. They were recently bought by the Meredith Corporation, yeah, funded by the Koch brothers, who are not left-leaning. Does that ownership situation concern you at all going forward, or have you given it any thought?
I've not met a soul with Meredith. I don't know anybody from Meredith. I don't. It's an interesting question. And I think that it's a question that obviously I'm going to have to consider. But having said that, do I once a week or so say something either on Twitter or in my column that is, what the hell is going on with this country right now? Yeah, and the reason I do that is because I don't want to wake up one morning and say, man, I should have said something. And I don't know where this country's going, but if somebody wants to not employ me because I want to occasionally give my opinions, I would hope that somebody else would want to employ me for what I do. But that would be up to them. I don't think we're at a point in the history of this country where people who have opinions about what's going on in this country should not give them. That's mm-hmm. That's just my feeling. I don't bash people over the head with it. I occasionally say it if I write a 9,000-word column and I have two sentences about something on the national scene. A lot of people kind of make a big deal of that and say I'm a socialist, and so I just say, look, you know, you can always skip over that part. It's like when I used to write about my kids playing field hockey and softball. You don't like it, skip over the part. That's 6% of the column this week, so yeah, that's kind of the way I feel about it.
So you mentioned earlier about how you probably don't want to be a boss going forward, but this is interesting to me because I saw your eyes light up earlier when a radio host complimented you on Jenny Vrentis's great piece on Belichick and Saban. Do you think there's an element of like knowing that you've fostered these things that has really made you fulfilled in a different way over the last 5 years versus being an individual sports writer?
I hired Jenny Vrentis. I hired Robert Klemko. Hired Albert Breer. Hired Tim Rohan. Hired Connor Orr. But it's them developing into the really good people that when you're young... The reason I hired those people is because A, they're really young, they're really aggressive, and the job is vitally important to them. When I hired the staff that we have now, and also when we hired Greg Bedard before that, here's the way I kind of look at it. I wanted to hire people who are a lot younger than me, and I wanted to hire people who was really, really important to. And so that's basically what happened. And my whole thing that I've learned from all of this is that it's so great to have people who aren't like you. You know, I have a few people in this business who are my peers and who I consider to be good friends who were really kind of unhappy when I didn't reach out to them and try to hire them when this whole thing started. And I just said this has to be about developing the next generation. You mentioned Jenny Vrentis. I mean, look, if I can be of some infinitesimal assistance in a story that she was going to do anyway, and she was going to do it exceedingly well, I'm glad I can do that. But, you know, Jenny needs the outlet to do these stories. We have another person on our staff, Kaylin Kaler, who was hired basically to be my administrative assistant. But she went to Northwestern, she went to Medill, and she is 24 years old, and she's going to be really, really good. And the reason that I know she's going to be really good is that she doesn't take no for an answer. She thinks of good stories, she develops them. She went up this year and did Nate Solder, and got a camera into Nate Solder's son, Hudson, has cancer, kidney cancer, and he's still undergoing treatment. Kaylin got a camera and her into the hospital to watch Hudson go through treatment and to watch Hudson's parents go through treatment. And at the end of the year, there were all kinds of national outlets when the Patriots went further, reaching out to Kaylin because Nate Solder would not allow anybody else to go into the hospital. And I'm not saying, oh, Kaylin, give her a Pulitzer, but that is the kind of person who I want to work with. You know, and I hope I have some, as I say, infinitesimal, a part of helping them take the step in their career. But as far as all that, I'm really, really happy to see young people. Quite honestly, I had two daughters. I'm really happy to see two young women on our staff right now really, really doing powerful things in our business. And I don't know. That's kind of how I feel.
You've obviously made your bones in football, and I've been following you all day. You love telling football stories to anybody who walks up and asks you, whether they're a former player or a radio host or somebody just in the mall approaching you. But I'm interested, do you, at this point in your life, enjoy watching a baseball game more than a football game, in part because you don't have to figure out a way to distill it into content?
Yes. I couldn't have put it any better than what you just said.
Well, I feel the same way because at the Big Lead, we have national readership and people are interested in football and basketball. So anytime I'm watching those two sports, I have to constantly be thinking, can this moment become a headline for me?
Yeah.
But with baseball, and I guess to a lesser extent soccer, I can watch them and just enjoy it and not have to at all think about a way that it can be turned into page views.
One of the things I love about going to a baseball game is that I like watching the tiny things. Like, I like watching, for instance, whoever positions the outfielders before a given play. I like, because here's the way I kind of look at baseball. Like, I'm sure Tom Verducci and Ken Rosenthal, John Heyman, these guys really know what all of these things like fielding ratings mean, UZR or whatever that silly rating thing is. But I find it absolutely totally fascinating. I was at a spring training game this year, and who was the guy, man? He was Espinoza. He played for Danny Espinoza. He played for Washington for a long time. This year, he played for Anaheim, I think, because I was in spring training in Arizona this year. And the most amazing thing happened where I just learned that baseball is such an incredible science now that I don't understand that well. Almost not quite to the level of football, but so Danny Espinoza, I think that's his name, maybe a second baseman for the Angels in spring training. I don't even know if he was on their team this year. But they put on a shift for Danny friggin' Espinoza, who might hit 212. And I said, my God, it's like the shift is not just for Big Poppy anymore. You know? And you see that more and more teams like are shifting for half of the lineup. They're basically daring you to hit into a weak part of your game. And things like that, I always think about, and I always think, like, people think baseball is a boring game. When I was a kid, baseball was the big game in our community and in my house. And my father was a pitcher. And so all of my time was spent trying to figure out, watching the game and trying to figure out how to get an edge. And I just loved it. And so what's so great about it now is that I can go to a game, I can have a couple of beers, I don't have to be concerned with a damn thing other than sitting there watching the game.
Talking to whoever's next to you.
Exactly. Just talking about the game. And I keep score at virtually every game I go to, I have my whole life. And thinking about a clean score sheet at the end of the game. That's a fun thing for me. It's a little nerdy part of my existence, but I really look forward to it every year, the start of the baseball season. I always am I have a little bit of melancholy every year on like October 3rd. I wake up on the Monday morning after the last day of the baseball season, regular season, I say, damn, the box scores are gone. You know, because I really enjoy spending 5 minutes at my table in New York every day just looking at the box scores and looking, say, at different guys who I want to put on my fantasy team or just who I'm following, you know, because I'm interested in them.
So I guess the last question before we got to go. When you interact with former players, it could be informal, it could be formal, but I've noticed you always ask them how they're feeling and whether it was worth it. What percentage of the players that you've asked that over the last several years say it was worth it, and what percentage say it wasn't worth it because of their various ailments or things that are happening to them now or they might be concerned about in the future?
Great question. The vast majority say it's worth it. And when guys say it isn't worth it, it's usually guys who've been wrecked by football. And, you know, like Ryan Harris today, the former Bronco, just a really bright guy. I don't know him well at all, but he interests me because he was always an introspective guy as a player. And I just think that most guys are going to have his reaction, which is like, fucking right, I'm glad I played, you know.
Well, what he said was, he said, I'm 32 years old and I have a couple million dollars in the bank. I host Drive Time Radio in Denver.
I've paid for my kids' education.
Yeah. I'm 32. I'm retired, and I'm black. That was his answer. I hope that wasn't off the record, but that's what he said.
Yeah, it was cool. Well, but I think the way overall I look at it is that. So this year, one of the projects we did at our site this year was we did a series called Football in America, and this was sort of the general manager of this project was Kaylin Kaler, this young writer who basically we went to 8 markets around the country, and we took the temperature of football, youth level, high school level, college level, pro level. I started it off in Oakland in week 2 of the season. Friday night game at Kezar Stadium in San Francisco, an inner city football game. Saturday morning we went to Marshawn Lynch's youth football program in Oakland, where he played youth football in Oakland. Then Saturday night we went to see Cal versus Ole Miss in Berkeley. And then Sunday we went to a Raiders game. So, and I'll tell you the one thing that really stuck out. And then we went to, an 8-man football game in Arizona with a quarterback who threw for 8 touchdowns or whatever. And we went everywhere. And the one thing I really wanted everybody I did the Bay Area one. Robert Klemko did Minnesota. Jenny Varentis did Philly. And everybody on the staff did it. Jonathan Jones did Charlotte. But I wanted everybody to sort of take the temperature of especially youth football, because I want to know what are people really thinking out there about the future of the game. So here's the most interesting thing that I learned in doing that series, at least for my section of it. We went to a game, Mission High School in San Francisco, and they have 2 coaches of their team. It's not a high level of football anymore, you know, in inner city San Francisco. And the one kid we focused on in San Francisco was a kid on this Mission High School team whose father was murdered in a home invasion when he was 10 years old, and he saw it happen.
Ooh.
And so when we talk to the mom who has been the mother hen in his life and has kept him on the straight and narrow and made sure that he stuck with an organized sport like football so that he'd have something in his life other than the streets, when we started talking to the mom, it seemed like such a dumb question to be talking about. Well, what about head trauma that might happen? You know, what about when he's 60 years old, if he gets early onset dementia or something like that? And she looked at us like we were the stupidest people. And she said, in essence, honey, I'm worried about my kids surviving until age 18. And this is the thing that helps him more than anything, more than school, more than me, more than anything, football. And so I just said to myself, that's why football's not going to go away. Now, Daryl Morey might be right. And I wrote a little something about Daryl Morey this week when he says football's dying. You know, in time it may die. But I do think...
Well, we've been hearing about the demographics of baseball viewers for 30 years now, since 80s, early 90s. The demographic's old, but for whatever reason, people, as they grow older, have adopted baseball watching when they weren't necessarily watching it when they were younger. But sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. That's
just
no, a digression. but you're right about that. But you know, if football does go away, I think it's going to be 2 or 3 generations from now. You know, it's interesting. I went to do a story on Jason Witten this year, and I got up in my hotel at the DFW airport on Saturday morning, got the paper, start flipping through the paper, And it's Saturday morning during the football season. There were seven open pages, broadsheet pages, on high school football from the night before. Seven. One of the pages had the aggregate results of every high school football game in the state of Texas from the previous night. And it went on forever. It was a river of scores. And so all of these communities in Texas, you know, all of them, I'm not saying they live for Friday night, but Friday Night Lights is a huge part of their existence. And so is it going to go away? It could, but it's a long way away. Now, I'll give you my one other point about all this. I have started to believe and have adopted the thought that, you know, the NFL has to get behind flag football for youth. It is nonsensical, in my opinion, for somebody in second grade to put on a helmet and shoulder pads and go out and try to demolish some kid on the other side of the line. It doesn't make any sense. We know too much about damage to the head. And so I think one of the things that Arthur Blank, Rich McKay, and the Atlanta Falcons did this year was genius. There's 159 counties in the state of Georgia. And what they did was they identified a youth group or a recreation department or whatever, a big one in each county. And they provided the seed money for a flag football program in that county. So 159 flag football organizations in the state of Georgia were birthed this year by the Atlanta Falcons. And my whole thing is, the Atlanta Falcons are not going to sit up and say, oh, kids shouldn't be playing tackle football anymore. They're not going to say that. But by their actions, they're saying kids shouldn't be playing tackle football until they're of a certain age. And look, it's really head in the sand for the NFL to not acknowledge and to, for some reason, to continue to push and push and push. And look, USA Football, those people are doing the absolute best job they can, and they're trying to keep the numbers up and all that. But I don't know how, if you are a parent of an 8-year-old boy who desperately wants to play football, you know, you got to be responsible. Find flag football for that kid. Get him to play. Deion Buchanan of the Arizona Cardinals told me something interesting 2 years ago in training camp. He grew up in San Diego, and he was a huge football fan as a kid. Huge. And he, the first 2 years, fifth and sixth grade, he played only flag football. There were two things. He was talking about the coaching, number one. You know, really, youth football, the coaches, you know, they just, hey, go out and kill that guy or whatever. I mean, maybe some of them are really good, but a lot of them probably aren't because they're not qualified to coach the game. But as he said, I was afraid of getting really hit hard when I'm in fifth grade. Who wants to get demolished and see stars? And, yeah. And who wants to do that? So he said, man, that got me to love football. 2 years of flag football. That got me to love football. Drew Brees didn't play tackle football until he was a sophomore in high school. Tom Brady first played tackle football when he was in high school. Jim Brown first played tackle football when he was in high school. So, come on. It shouldn't take Congress to legislate common sense. Flag football should be the norm for kids who play youth football.
Thank you, Peter.
Sure.
Will you notice if I don't notice you?